Session number 9862, Brigadier Ralph Bagnold, Part 1.
Where were you born, Brigadier Bagnold?
I was born in Plymouth.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was in the Army, in the Royal Engineers.
What was your education?
Oh, I was educated at Malvern College, and then Royal Military Academy at Woolwich, as it then was. And after the First War, I went to Cambridge.
What did you read there?
Engineering.
At which college was that?
Caius, Carnarvon and Caius.
How did you come to join the forces?
I was going in anyway. My father was in the Army. I was destined to go into the Army in any case. Hopefully in the Royal Engineers like him. And my school days ended in the summer of 1914, and I found myself going to Royal Military Academy automatically.
Did you actually see any action during the First World War?
Oh yes, I was in France and Belgium from 1915 to the end, in a field company, in an engineer field company.
Were you wounded?
No. I managed to survive.
Whereabouts did you see most of your service in the First World War?
In France and Belgium, entirely.
Can you name some of the localities?
Oh, Ypres, the Ypres salient, and the Somme. And we moved around, the division moved around one place to another. Sometimes they in a quiet sector of the line, sometimes not. Ypres salient was never quiet.
What was morale like amongst the officers in those days?
Very hard to tell. The infantry had it pretty badly. But it depended what situation you were.
What about your own morale? Was it good, or did you ever get depressed about it?
Oh, I got depressed at times. One saw all one's friends disappearing one by one. And, of course, it was the contrast, really. It was pretty awful in the front line. Then when the division went back into rest areas for a week or so, and it was freedom and enjoyment. It was contrast.
What was the feeling of you and your brother officers towards the Germans? Did you hate them or respect them or what?
Oh, they were just the Bosch. I don't suppose one thought about them except as an enemy.
Did you ever think that we might lose the First World War?
No, I don't think so, but the idea was it might go on forever. One got rather... It was a way of life. I was only 19, and I know no other kind of adult life. It was a way of life. And when the war ended, when the armistice came, the bottom seemed to drop out of life altogether. One didn't know where one was. All the aims one thought were the most important aims in life had suddenly dropped.
A kind of sense of anticlimax.
Yes.
Can I ask you how you came to be interested in deserts?
Well, after the First War, 1926, I happened to be posted to Egypt. And there it dawned on me that the motor transport of any kind had been introduced into Egypt during the First War, nothing before, notably the Ford Model T Ford car. But the general opinion was, even then, that the motor car was meant for roads. And as there were no roads out of Egypt, and only the only roads were along the Nile Valley, we thought it was I and a few other like people thought it was rather restricting, and that why shouldn't one use Ford cars to travel across country and make roads for ourselves or go along camel tracks? And we developed. We were the sort of pioneers of desert motoring, and we developed it to such an extent that we managed to be self-contained in water and food and petrol for as much as 1,500 miles. And we were able to penetrate further into the Libyan desert than anyone had penetrated before.
Who were your colleagues in this work?
Oh, a group of young army officers in the tank corps, and engineers and signals. And we spent our periods of leave in doing that sort of thing rather than spending it in the sporting club at Kuthera.
In the sporting club?
Well, there was a wonderful sporting club at Cairo, laid out as a sporting ground for the British Army by Lord Kitchener in the early days, the beginning of the century. Oh, it was a wonderful place. There was every kind of sport imaginable was available.
Did you find the desert an attractive place?
Oh, most attractive. The idea of being, it's rather like yachting at sea, ocean yachting. One could go where one liked, and never quite knowing what you're going to find over the next horizon. It's not been mapped, only just the Egyptian part of the Libyan desert has been mapped. So one really didn't know what were you going to find over the next horizon, which made it very interesting and exciting.
Did you have many problems with the Model T Ford?
None. We knew after a year or so they were all exactly like one another. So we knew how many miles we were going to travel before something broke, and you had a spare part for that particular part. One got an enormous amount of expertise. We had to navigate by the stars and by dead reckoning.
Did you know whether any other nationalities were taking a similar interest at that time?
There were none. Nobody was taking interest. No one had thought of driving across country.
What did your brother officers think of your activities in the desert?
Oh, they were very keen to come. They all enjoyed it. Everybody who ever travelled in the desert had developed an extraordinary liking for it. There's something very attractive about it, a real desert, lifeless desert. It's the most arid area in the world. You can travel for, several thousand miles without seeing a bit of life, a vegetable or animal.
What about the native people there?
There are none, you see, because it's waterless. Water, anyway, it rains in any one place on average about 70 to 100 years. So it's completely waterless. In the middle, that is. There's a lot of water along the Mediterranean coast, a lot of rain. But within 50 miles of the Mediterranean coast, it doesn't rain. You would go do without it. There are oases. Strange oases which don't exist, or in Australia perhaps, where the wind has scoured in times past, has scoured the ground out until it goes down to the water table, perhaps 1,000 feet below. You get these oases of holes in the ground where artesian water from elsewhere in Africa seeps through and comes up as a spring. Apart from that, there's no water at all. So there's no vegetation, there's no nothing. And you get to take an interest in archaeology. Everything is on the surface because it's an erosion desert. It's been going down and down by the wind. So that early Paleolithic man have his remains scattered around implements. You've got also a little heap in the of sand. You scrap it away and found the ashes of a hearth where prehistoric man has had a meal. You find flint implements around.
What about the landforms in the desert? How did you become interested in their formation?
Well, it was automatic. You travel over a country, you naturally become interested in how it was formed. in that sort of country. It's very strange, because you're being a wind erosion desert. None of the forms one expects in land. For instance, river, there are no river valleys, no continuity. We have a hollow which the wind has dug out, an isolated hollow. We have an isolated hill that's been left behind. But no continuity of river valleys or mountain ridges. So it's, to the uninitiated, it's a very frightening place, because one, if you turn around, you don't know in the least where you are or how to get home, because there's nothing you recognize. You can say, if I follow this valley, it'll get me home, because there aren't any valleys.
It must have been extraordinary to find signs of past life, past human life, in such waterless conditions.
Well, one realized that it happened half a million years ago, or less, that it was a little bit more rain. If there were only a little bit more rain, or more frequent rain, some vegetation will keep going.
What was the most exciting archaeological find you made?
Well, personally, I think it was sheltering one evening from the cold wind to find somewhere to sleep. I crept into a hollow where a piece of caprog had fallen down and left a hollow underneath. I crept in for shelter for the night and took off my wristwatch and felt in the dark. I found a little ridge of rock inside. My hand went along the ridge and fingers clasped the stone knife, which had been left there by somebody for exactly the same reason many thousands of years ago.
What was it like, the stone knife?
Stone implement. I forget what it looked like at the moment.
Just about a few inches long?
Yes, about 6 inches long, I suppose.
Was it highly polished or rough?
It seemed to be, as far as I remember, it seemed to be a early Neolithic, probably quite well worked.
Was it easy to find these implements? Were they all over the place?
Yes, in places, in certain areas. You find them, most of them, on the areas around sand dunes, not on the dunes, but around them. They grew crops on the sand dunes, the Neolithic people, because that's where the water, rain went down into the sand and was retained for perhaps a year. It could grow a crop before it dried away. But elsewhere, the desert, the water simply evaporated on the surface. So as you find that the implements are usually concentrated around the sand dunes, including querns, large querns for grinding corn.
Can we go on to the outbreak of the Second World War, and can you tell me what your reaction to that was?
Well, I think it was, oh dear, here's another war. I had retired before the war, some years. I was recalled as a reservist, and eventually found myself in Egypt. And because of a collision at sea in the Mediterranean, both ships limped into Port Said to get repairs. I took the opportunity of taking the train to Cairo to look up old friends. And I was met by a friend who said, "You're just the man, because Wavell wants to see you."
Can you remember who the friend was?
A man called Miller, Colonel Miller, a Canadian in this sigil, what we call sigils. I thought to myself, why? Wavell's a very senior general. How is he out here? He must be far senior to the commander on the spot. And I was told, hush, he's not supposed to be here. He's collecting information and planning something. So I went to see Wavell, stocky, short, jockey mare with one eye. And one felt there was something about him that made one think he has a very strong personality. And he said, where are you going? I said, I've been posted to East Africa. And he said, wouldn't you rather be here? And I said, yes, certainly I would. He said, I'll fix it. And within 48 hours, I was reposted to Egypt. When the war broke out, when the hot war broke out in June 1940, I saw that there was we had no real preparations for a war in Egypt at all. In fact, the army in Egypt was there, had been there since 1870, merely for internal security purposes, and as a force to protect the Suez Canal. So there was no preparation had been made for an invasion of Egypt at all. So when the hot war broke out, the Italians declared war, France collapsed, I took up my courage in my hands and sent a note, asked a friend of mine to put it on the Commander-in-Chief's personal desk. And within half an hour, I was sent for, and Wavell was alone. And he said, tell me about this. He sat me in an armchair, very quietly. He said, tell me about this, and I told him what I thought was wrong. And that we ought to have some mobile ground scouting force, or even a very small scouting force, to be able to penetrate the desert to the west of Egypt, to see what was going on, because we had no information about what the Italians might be doing.
How did he react?
He said, well, if you find the Italians aren't doing anything in the interior at all, I said, without thinking, how about some piracy on the high desert?
How about some what?
Some piracy on the high desert. And his rather stern face broke into a broad grin. He said, can you be ready in 6 weeks? And I said, yes, provided. Yes, I know, he said. There'll be opposition, a delay. He rang his bell, and a lieutenant general came in as the chief of staff. And Wavell said, Arthur, Bagnall seeks a talisman. We'll get this typed out, and I'll sign it straight away. I wish that any demand, that any request made by Major Bagnall in person should be met instantly and without question. It was typed, and Wavell signed it, and it was a talisman. I could complete carte blanche to do anything I liked.
Did you have in mind a reconnaissance force or a raiding force?
A reconnaissance, mainly. Perhaps a bit of both. But the expertise I had, which no one else had any inkling of in Egypt at the time, was that one can travel self-contained for 1,500 miles over any country. We knew how to cross dunes. We knew how to travel, to navigate anywhere.
How would you cross dunes?
You'd find a place, a special place where the sand was hard and hadn't been avalanched down by advancing, and advancing face avalanching down makes it very soft.
How did your force develop then?
Well, within 6 weeks, we'd got together a volunteer force of New Zealanders, who had arrived in Egypt. The New Zealand division had arrived in Egypt, having been promised that their arms and equipment would be supplied. And their ship carrying them had been sunk by a submarine, so they were at a loose end.
Is that the only reason why you chose them?
No, I wanted people who were I wanted responsible volunteers who knew how to look after things and maintain things, rather than a British Tommy who was apt to be wasteful. And there were a marvellous lot of people, mostly sheep farmers, in a big way, who were responsible and had fleets of trucks of their own.
So the New Zealanders were more careful with their equipment, were they?
Well, they were sensible enough to realise that going a long, long way away from hundreds of miles away from help, they had to be very, very careful of looking after things. In fact, the first trip into inside enemy territory, we travelled 150,000 truck miles without losing a single truck.
When was that first trip? Can you recollect?
It's in September 1940.
What was the objective?
The objective was to see whether the Italian... We could track raid, you see, and if there was any planning any raid against southern Egypt, which meant they had to have a lot of transport moving south for 600 miles to their outpost at Oenad. We could track read and see how much traffic there had been. If there had been no traffic much, except perhaps one or two small convoys of carrying supplies and mail to the outposts in the interior, if there was no real mess up on the sand, we knew that they hadn't got the initiative to plan any raid. You see, if they could, from their outpost at Oenat on the Egyptian-Sudan border, they could have raided Aswan, seized the dam, and said, "If you try to attack us, we'll open the sluices and cause an unseasonable flood and wreck Egypt." So, to my mind, it was quite a possibility, especially as I'd met an Italian party in the desert 10 years before, and we had discussed that very thing as a joke, how easy it was for them to raid the Nile.
Who was this Italian party?
Only just been able to penetrate inland from the coast. And in 1930, they'd captured Kufra, the central oasis in the Libyan desert. And in exultation, I suppose, of having captured Kufra at last, they pushed on until we found them with the aircraft, an army and an aircraft in Sudan territory. We found them in Sudan territory, where of course they should not be. But we were very matey. They gave us a wonderful dinner, lots of wine. I reported the whole thing afterwards to the Foreign Office.
Did they seem concerned?
Not very. They were too exhilarated at having penetrated so far. The chap I thought quite a lot of was a man called Lorenzini.
Eni?
Lorenzini.
How do you spell it?
Lorenzini. I thought if he was still in Libya, that he was capable of doing that sort of raid himself.
Why did you think so much of him?
Oh, his personality, his the way he talked, what he knew, and he liked it, is it, like me.
So you felt that this first venture into the desert with the New Zealanders was successful?
It was successful because we found that there was no idea of Italians doing anything in the south. Also, we captured a small convoy.
How did that come about?
We just met them on the track.
Did you ambush them, or?
Oh, saw them coming along, miles away. And they just surrounded them. They couldn't do anything.
Were there any shots fired?
No, I don't think so, no.
What was their reaction to being captured?
Was anyone's reaction to being captured just shrug their shoulders and say, that's how it is.
How many did you take?
Oh, not many, half a dozen. But when you capture people in the desert, of course, you're just people together. They can't escape because there's nowhere for them to escape to. If they tried to escape, they'd die. So you get along with them quite nicely.
What was the next development in the formation of the Long Range Desert Group?
Well, you see, the first trip was so successful. In fact, we went right across the desert and managed to join up with the French in Chad. So we travelled a very long way, so successfully that the initial group of three patrols I had formed was doubled. And the idea, Wavell's idea, which I grasped after a bit, he was a man who never said what was in his mind. You had to guess it. But I guessed that his idea was psychological. You see, the Italians had a 600-mile unprotected flank. They were trying to attack Egypt along the Mediterranean coast from bases long, long way to the west. Because it meant disobeying all the rules of strategy, leaving an enormously long, unprotected flank. They thought that as it was...